Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome again to this week's episode of It's Easy, Son, life lessons on your journey to your promise. As always, today I'm excited because I have a friend and colleague joining me, a friend from years ago that watched him rise and watched his career. Forget the fact that we attended the same high school together on a different era and have this purple bond, but I'm excited that he joined us today, an Olympic coach, still an athlete in his own right, but now he leads and guides young people at Clemson University. And more importantly, he's also an Olympic coach for the island of Jamaica. And a gentleman, a man filled with faith, a man filled with mentorship and fatherhood and you name it in terms of guiding young people. Ladies and gentlemen, on the podcast for this week is none other than Mr. Lennox Graham, assistant track and field coach at Clemson University, and more importantly, a mentor and father figure to so many athletes around the world. So with no further ado, ladies and gentlemen, we welcome to the show this week, Mr. Lennox Graham. Coach Graham, how you doing, sir?
Hey, Gerald. Good to be here, man. Good to be on your show. I'm doing really well.
That's always good to hear. It's always good to follow you on social media as well to see what you're doing. Still getting young people to the next level, and that's something that I know you were born to do, so it's always a pleasure watching that. Well, as my guest today, I'll start out by just explaining the ground rules of how we will operate and function. And I don't talk as much. I always say that up front. But this is really a time to dialogue with you. And hopefully through this dialogue, we can get some nuggets of wisdom. We can get also some sense of your journey to where you are today, a successful international coach in track and field. But more importantly, to get a sense of where you started and the path that your life has taken thus far. So I will pull back now and just ask the opening question and we can have a dialogue and conversation. So just jumping right in, tell us about Lennox Graham and who he is and what's his foundation and what basically drives him from his early years to where he is today.
Well, Lennox Graham is a pretty focused and driven individual. Born in Jamaica, born in Kingston, Jamaica, but grew up in rural Jamaica in Clarendon, the parish of Clarendon, where I did what we call my primary school years and passed my exams, came back to Kingston to live at age 10 or 11, attended Kingston College for 8 years, did the upper sixth form twice. We were banned from the high school championships when I was in my lower sixth form. So upper six, we were actually banned. Lower six, I ran. Upper six, we were banned. And then I went back and repeated upper sixth form to have an opportunity for a scholarship. Started track and field really early in my life. I think it may be seventh, eighth grade. Ran track for Kingston College until I became the captain in my lower 6 years. Was still the captain in the year we were banned, and then came back for my repeat upper 6 year as a captain, and we won that championships coming from, we were listed as 41 for that championship, actually, because there were then 41 schools that participated in the high school championships on the boys' side. Then the boys' championships were separated from the girls' championships. It's a little bit different now where they're combined. And so we were number 41. And by the end of that championship, we were at number one. So that was a pretty awesome feat. Left high school on scholarship to Alabama State University in Montgomery, Alabama. Spent 3.5 years there. Got my degree in business administration, computer information systems. Went back home to Jamaica to work. Started working in the insurance business as a IT professional. And did quite a few different jobs while I was there. Actually, at one time was information technology consultant in the office of the prime minister. And that was a pretty rewarding job. But while I did that, that was my paid job. I actually volunteered at my old high school, Kingston College, as a track and field coach. Volunteer duties took me 14 years of volunteer work. And it was all about trying to make. Yes, sir. 14 years.
Wow.
of And became even the head coach at Kingston College as a volunteer. And that was extremely rewarding for me because I saw quite a bit of a few, more than a few young men and even some ladies, because I started also voluntarily coaching some ladies from Alpha High School, Convent of Mercy Alpha High School, and saw some young men and some young ladies get opportunities for tertiary education as a result. And that was extremely rewarding. So we did that for 14 years, and fast forward to 2006, I think I met you at the Penn Relays, saw you at the Penn Relays, and you spoke about an opportunity to be at Johnson C. Smith Division II University. We took that opportunity up, interviewed on that campus by Dr. Yancey and, of course, our AD, Stephen Joyner, and got the job. And that put me in Charlotte for 10 years as head coach of Johnson C. Smith University. Enjoyed that immensely. There were a whole lot of challenges, but we already know perseverance built character and character hope. So that was me learning on the job and having quite a bit of success, conference championships, team championships, NCAA individual champions, team trophies on the NCAA side. And after doing that for 10 years, getting Olympians, world championship representatives and medalists, and eventually while they're a world champion in the 100-meter hurdles in Daniel Williams. So it was very rewarding. And it was in 2017, while at the world championship, as a member of the Jamaican coaching staff, that I got this call up from Clemson, and Coach Elliott and I spoke about some things, and as God would have it, here I am at Clemson University for the last 3 years as the assistant coach in charge of the long sprints and the hurdles.
Wow. So you went from being born in Clarendon all the way to Clemson, where you are today, and you fit quite a bit in there. What I'd like to do, though, is ask you a couple of questions, because all that you have laid out thus far required some measure of discipline, and you mentioned perseverance. But tell the audience a little bit about your early years. What was the family, the Graham family, like? And what was a part of that family? What was instilled in you from that early age for you to take this path? I call it meteoric, because I've had a chance to see it up front and close. But foundationally, family and your early years in development, what was that like?
Well, growing up in rural Jamaica in Clarendon, with both mom and dad, older brother, and older twin sisters. So we had four children in the household. My brother was the eldest. I was the youngest. And so it was a pretty nice living. Both were educators. My dad was the principal of a primary school. My mom taught there. Eventually, my dad became an education officer, and my mom became principal of the primary school. So it was pretty decent, but it was challenging in some ways. As the last one in the family, you always had to kind of chart a path for yourself, earn your respect, so to speak. And so I was a very determined young man. A lot of the influences I had came from my mom. She was extremely humble. She was hardworking. And I think I got that from her. My dad was a disciplinarian, so he was extremely strict. House had to be in order. Everything had to be in place. He introduced me to some farming, which was not something I liked. So obviously I knew that I wanted to get something out of my education and not want to go back to farming. So there was a lot of drive there. And then once I took my common entrance examination and passed for Kingston College from a rural school, I did pretty well on the exam. Then you went into a Kingston College situation where you did not know too many people in the entire school.
Wow.
You were this the rural kid. A lot of the kids there knew each other. I didn't know them. And so, you know, again, you had to kind of chart a path for yourself. As you know, a boys' school is pretty rough. And so you had to grow up pretty fast. I was also at that time living in the Kingston 11 area, which was also a pretty rough area. And so you kind of learn street life or streets to be street smart pretty early. And a lot of that would have to be self-taught because I was living with my aunt and my uncle in Cockburn Penn is where I lived.
Wow.
And
yeah.
So you had to grow up pretty fast. It was a time in the mid-70s when political violence was rampant in that area. You had people dying on a regular basis. You had the helicopters coming over at night, and we would come off the bus coming from school, and there would be a floodlight watching you all the way till you get to your house. So it was pretty tough surroundings, but it taught me a lot of grit, a lot of determination. And I knew then that I needed to do something with my life to get to be at a better place educationally and also just standard of life. So there was a lot of things in my early years that kind of drove me to be very determined to succeed.
Now, we are always the Qs because we are both fortisons, so to speak. And this purple and white mantle that's placed around our necks and the aura of a Bishop Gibson and Mr. Forrest and Ivan Johnson and Helen Douglas and people like that that we all kind of came up with. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about what that family of Kingston College and the Fortis spirit meant for you in your development to this day.
Well, Kingston College was very, very, very important to my development. And going there, like I said, early years, you met a lot of people who are still your close friends today. We all take different paths, but there's just something about Kingston College where even if you move to Siberia to live, you're going to find yourself gravitating towards some Kingston College people.
That's right.
Whether it's, and thank God for technology now that they don't have to be in Siberia with you in order for you to, there's just something about having that common way of looking at life that never say die, that never yield. We always talk about the brave may fall, but I think I gravitate towards the part that says, but never yield. And so there's that in me that keeps me going no matter what the opposition. I have coined a phrase that I live by. It says, excellence does not tolerate mediocrity. Wow. And it's based on Kingston College. It's based on never yielding. It's based on being brave and about everything that you do in this life and just being excellent. Excellent is not about the result. Excellent is about the input, which you control. So if you're playing a game of soccer, you're going to put your all into it. If you're raising a family as a dad, you're going to put your all into it. If you have to, in my case, go back and do your master's at 40 years old, you're going to put your all into it. If you get someone in front of you who is determined to self-destruct, you're just not going to allow them to self-destruct because you're putting your all into that. And so mentorship grew out of that. And I, there are lots of stories that many people will have, some humorous, some not. But at the end of the day, for those who I interacted with over my lifetime, most of them, when they have left, then they have a lot of stories to tell while they're where I am. Sometimes it's not that fun because I think I also got that disciplinarian thing from my dad. And so I was called that at some point in time in my high school coaching career, disciplinarian. That's what they called me because I was kind of no nonsense.
So you're known as Sir G. So Sir G comes from that disciplinarian side of things or the humorous side of things?
I think Sir G came from the disciplinarian side of things initially, because that's the initial experience that most people have. And then when they get to know me, it became just an affectionate way of saying, Sir Graham, because they realized that I was a really down-to-earth person who could talk to youngsters at on any level, which was very important, especially when you're in a boys' school. You want to be able to talk about the things that young boys are interested in and use all those things as teaching moments for them. So while they're talking about a topic for the fun of it, you find a way to show them a lesson in it as you try to groom them to be the men that they would eventually become.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I definitely want the audience to hear is that not only were you an athlete, you were a student athlete, and you mentioned being in the upper six, and education has always been the bedrock for you. But as you think about going through Kingston College, returning to coaching at Kingston College, being successful at that, the term student athlete is thrown around quite a bit today. What does that term mean to you as not only a coach, but a coach in a collegiate and high school setting? What does student athlete mean to you?
Well, for me, when I think of the term student athlete, that word student is in all caps. And then the athlete portion is in lowercase. As someone who lived that, as a student first getting to Kingston College, I was not one of those people who went there because I had athletic ability. I just went there because I passed my required entrance exams to get there. And then to be there and realize at some point, I love soccer, but I realized even at that tender age that more people were getting opportunities to go for tertiary education through track and field than soccer. And so I chose to do that. And I was successful, thank God, in doing that. It was not easy, but I was successful in getting a scholarship to Alabama State University. And then while there, you quickly realized that this thing was temporary. So I was not one of those people who dreamt of being an Olympic champion or a world champion. You want to be the best that you could be, and you want to win against the people who you race. But I always knew that it was going to take education, and especially coming from a family of educators where my dad and my mom were both educators, then I knew that that was the way to becoming somewhat independent as a man.
Wow.
To be able to be financially independent. So it was always a student first approach for me. When I got in there, I remember getting into Alabama State University, and in my first semester, I almost failed my English class. And it taught me a lot, because it wasn't that I didn't know grammar or how to put a sentence structure together, but I couldn't spell in the American way.
Yeah.
The British, and we didn't have too many computers then. So when you submitted papers, it was, and I know I date myself by saying that, but you wrote papers, you typed papers. And so you would be able to put the ideas down, but you were putting an extra U in color or an S where America wanted a Z, and you got graded down for those things. So it was a culture shock, but it was an important lesson for me to learn, because when you want something, when you want to be excellent at something, then you have to put the work in. And so I put a lot of work in. I was very competitive internally. I remember we had some people who were there who just automatically thought they should be the most brilliant in class, and the competitive person I am, I'm like, I got to beat those people. And of course, I put the work in the background and got the job done. So student athlete is always going to be student first. Once I got out of there, was successful, got back to Jamaica, got a decent job to start with, and then started mentoring kids, it was only reasonable or normal for me to push that student first approach to them. And especially when you had kids who were from less than fortunate homes, who you're trying to teach them that God gave them a talent. However, if they have the educational component with it, then they will get an opportunity to make something better of themselves. Sometimes they never dreamed of coming out of a certain lifestyle. And then as you got one person to buy in, and that person got an opportunity to go overseas, and that person was able to tell stories to the people who were still there, and it was easy enough to sell to the younger kids what your dream for them was, because they could see their big brothers. And Kingston College is one of those schools where everybody is each other's brother. Mm-hmm. When you go away and you graduate, you come back as an alum, these are really your sons. I look at them as my sons, but the day they graduate, they become my brothers. Right. So I could be 30 years old, and my son could be 14, 15, 16, 17, and he graduates, and all of a sudden I have an 18-year-old brother.
Right.
And so you just don't stop caring for them. They're your sons, and then they become your little brothers. So you're their dad, and then you become their big brother. And that's what Kingston College is unique in to me. And it's not just that you say it, it's that you live it.
Wow, that is so powerful. So let me ask you this question. I had the good privilege of having Danielle Williams on the podcast earlier, and I asked her this question, and I'm going to ask it to you as well. Given you were in Jamaica, went to high school in Jamaica, and this tension now that exists between going overseas for tertiary education in the NCAA system or staying home, she gave me her perspective. What is your perspective on that with the student athlete, the student care, the student's future being at the forefront? How do you shape or how do you see that discussion or debate?
Well, I really don't see it as a debate. Each individual at the end of high school, if that individual is a very good student athlete, will have an opportunity to either go overseas or stay at home. Now, there's a lot involved in that. That individual could be pretty good at track and field, and they also could be pretty good at their classwork, the academic piece. But there needs to be mentorship in the part of this is what you will need for the NCAA if you really want to go there, or the NAIA, or the JUCO. So my view is, when you have someone who is obviously talented in front of you, and they're obviously good student athletes, my approach is you should prepare them for every option, meaning you should teach them about math, English, the sciences, the social sciences. You should teach them how to master their athletic event. And you should also teach them what's the requirement to get into UTEC, into UWI, UWI, University of the West Indies, or into an institution overseas. And they should know that. It is our responsibility as mentors, as adults who have the experience and understand what it will take in life to get through in life, to teach our young kids those things. Once they know all those things and they prepare themselves for all those things, then the decision becomes, does this individual want to stay home or do they want to go overseas? And so it's not a debate for me. It's just being totally interested in the young man or woman, young boy or girl that's in front of you, interested enough that you want to give them a chance at all the options.
Right.
Now, they could choose to stay home, and that's fine. But if they stay home, that you as the mentor should see to it that they are doing something that will carry them past track and field.
Right, right.
I have this debate so many times, and people think it's a debate. I'm just saying this is just a conversation. But I know that I never get into this conversation about whether the athletes or the coaches who are overseas are better than the athletes or the coaches who are at home. Because in the grand scheme of things, maybe 1.5% of those athletes, regardless of where they go, will be able to make a living out of track and field. It's never, ever a debate about which coach is better or which athlete is better. The real reality is the sport globally does not have room for more than 1.5 to, if you want to be really generous, 2% of the people who participate in the sport who can make a living out of the
wow.
sport.
1.5 to 2%?
That's my
That is
belief.
Stunning. That is stunning. That is stunning.
Belief. So if you start looking at the global position and not just I have a champion in front of me that I think will be good and so he could make this money or she could make that money. I don't have the research behind it, but I'm sure the average life of the average professional is not much more than 7 to 10 years.
Right.
And when you start talking average, it might really be 5 years. Right. Of course, there's a lot of people who go to the professional and get one contract and never get the second. But
right.
for the sake of this conversation and without the research, let's say it's 8 to 10 years. So that person at age 30, 28, is starting to look at what's next in my life.
Right.
And I'm a man of God. And my Bible says we will get an average of 70, which is 70.
Right. Yep, yep.
Now, if you are 28 or 30, and now you're going to say, what next? You probably on average have 40 to 42 more years to think about.
That's right.
So when we mentor the kids, even if they're at from the primary level, the prep level, coming through the high school level, let's mentor them with the long game in mind. So if you're going to take a gamble with a kid's life, let's look at the probabilities. If the probability is 2% will really make it on this side, but the probability is higher on the academic side, let's make sure that we have the academic side covered. That's my approach. And then if you fall within that 2%, you're good.
Right. You know, Coach, one of the reasons why I raised this and what the wisdom that you're putting forth right now, just had to let the audience have some sense of what you've accomplished. You've had athletes that in the same year, they have been both valedictorian and salutatorian at commencement. Your athletes on average every year had some of the highest GPAs in the nation. Are these the results based on your philosophy of what you're just sharing here about the importance of student first?
It has something to do with it, Gerald. Obviously, the kid is that gets the valedictorian or salutatorian, they are brilliant kids. Yeah. But my job is, when they walk in the door, I try to explain the system as I know it. So, for example, let's say that this is an international student. When I was at Johnson C. Smith, a lot of my recruits that made it to the international level were international students. In other words, they turned up at the World Championships, the Commonwealth Games, the Pan Am Games, Central American and Caribbean Games, and so on at the Olympics. They were international students. Let's say an international student come in. My first job is to explain to them the difference between the British system, in which exists in the Caribbean, and the American system. And I'm talking about the way of testing, how they evaluate on the academic side. So in the British system, it's now you have the SBA, so it's a little different, but you're heavily graded based on one exam that you take, heavily graded based on one exam. In the U.S. system, everything counts to your final grade, literally everything.
Mm-hmm.
Attendance, discussion and participation in class, everything. Quizzes are not just stuff to see if you knew what we just took, but this is going to be a part of your grade, and you know what percentage of your grade is going to be up front. Through high school in the Caribbean system, you have the mid-semester exams or midterm exams, you have your end-of-term exams, and those are what carry all your grade almost. When you start taking the external exams and you have the SBA, so you could do some stuff on the way, but But a big part of it is what you do on that one day that you sit down and take that exam, whether paper one or paper two or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I explain the difference, and I explain the difference in the approach that they need to take. Procrastination has to go out the window. And I can explain it from the theory side, and I can also explain it from the practical side. So I will tell them, I graduated, I think, with a 3.89 or something like that, GPA. I was a president, the top GPA in my graduating class at Alabama State University, and I'm a student athlete. And I explained to them that I was not a brilliant kid.
Right.
I just figured out how to make it work for myself. So I would sit a student athlete down early in our relationships, coach-athlete relationship in college at Johnson C. Smith University, and I would tell them, this is what Coach Graham did. I got my syllabus. I actually went through it. I tried to be ahead in my reading. Before I go to class, I do my reading. I take and I write notes. Also, put question signs where I didn't have a clue what they were saying. When I went to class, I listened. I did not talk in class. You could not distract me. I made notes. I compared the notes to the notes I made before. If I still didn't get it, that professor is going to hear from me. I'm going to go to their office. I'm going to figure it out.
Right.
So I had notes before, I had notes after, and in between I'm listening. And so every quiz that came up, I could ace that quiz because I was on top of things. It's not that I was smart, like I could just listen and regurgitate or listen and understand. I don't think I was, but I think I was very disciplined. And so when I could tell them the theory and then I could tell them what I did practically, I'm not saying they have to do it the same way, but it's just the real deal was find the approach that works for you and be excellent at it. And you will be able to get the best grades possible for you. Now, everybody won't be able to get straight A's, but you will be definitely be able to get the results that are the best possible results for you.
Wow.
And once they buy into that, man, then the rest is history.
Sky is the limit. And so
and a habit and a habit is easy to form.
Right.
You know, I usually just tell them, hey, if you spend 21 days doing this thing, you'll form a habit that will never leave you. And then I tell them the next thing is your easiest classes are usually your first two semesters. And so if you could get a 4.0 in that, then encouragement sweetens labor.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So coach.
I usually tell my kids, Gerald, that when you come to the university your first day, you have straight A's. And they would be like, Coach, no, we haven't gotten a test yet. I said, yeah, you have straight A's. Now hold on to that as long as possible. And that's the approach.
That's the approach. So, Coach, let me ask you this. You've shared already what you have done, perseverance, and all of these things that are rooted in you from an early age. And you go to Alabama A&M, obviously was successful. They're still
Alabama State.
Alabama State. You still have records there, I think, on the track, if I'm not mistaken. So
I think I have the sprint hurdle record.
Right.
I keep telling Coach, we need to recruit better, man.
Yes, that blazing time that's there, huh? But you ended up going back home to Jamaica versus staying here in the States and going through. What was the return to Jamaica like after going through the college experience here?
You know what, Gerald, when I was a student athlete at Alabama State University, I think I shared this in another podcast, I had great times in Montgomery, Alabama. But the reality of Montgomery, Alabama in the early 80s was that I was going to school with kids who their parents were in the civil rights movement. They understood that firsthand, being 19 years old, 20 years old, 17 years old. They understood that firsthand. And I had no clue at that time about the civil rights movements. I, I said on another podcast that it was during my time at Alabama State University, I realized that I was black. Not that I thought I was, but I didn't think it mattered. I was just a Jamaican. I didn't, you know, Jamaicans come in all kinds of shade and look differently, man. Some are light, some are black, some are Indians, Caucasians, Chinese, Asian descent. We have all these different, that's why we said out of many one people. And so it was while at the HBCU, at Alabama State University, it suddenly dawned on me that I was black. It suddenly dawned on me that being black was kind of difficult.
Right.
Because as I explained to some people, when slavery was abolished in Jamaica, the black people were the majority. So we did not have that kind of oppression. There are different kind of problems in Jamaica, but one of them was not your race. So that was a big learning experience for me. Back then, also, you had people who were pretty bitter. And even though I was black and they were black, you still got the feeling like, you come in here to get my job, and I already don't have a lot of opportunities. So honestly, man, a part of it, even though I enjoyed my college years at Alabama State University, a part of it was I was in a hurry to get back home.
Wow.
Because I couldn't change the fact that I was black, and I didn't want to change it, and I couldn't change the fact that I was a foreigner. And so there was stuff stacked, in my mind anyway, at that stage and age, stacked up against me. So I was one of those few who went directly back home, but I was in a hurry to get back to Jamaica. When I landed back in Jamaica, it was like, wow, yeah, guys, I'm back. I'm home. And I was happy to be home. I remember having a conversation with my wife, with my girlfriend then, once we got married and people started, you know, people like to talk about, oh, we're going back to America, a relative filing for you or whatever. I'm like, I'm not going back. I've seen enough.
Right.
So I was home and I was happy to be back home. I was never, ever planning to be back in the U.S. This is just what God had planned for me. And I'm blessed now to be back here and happy to be back here. But back then when I got home, Gerald, I was happy to be back on the rock, man.
Yeah, I could imagine. So you get back, you land a couple of jobs, and you end back at your alma mater, Kingston College. And talk to us a little bit about that. We have about 20 minutes left, but I want the audience to get a sense of just what you accomplished in the modern day era, I would say still modern day era, of Boys Champs, and how that has propelled you to where you are today.
Well, when I got back, I was working. I got my first job in information technology. I was a programmer analyst and doing all this stuff. At one point, I was an information technology consultant at the Office of the Prime Minister. I was one of those people who also was in the START group that started up Digicel in Jamaica. Back then, it was Mozelle, and we launched Digicel in Jamaica. I was on the IT side. Still have some good friends who were a part of that group. But while doing that, I was volunteering at Kingston College. I went to the championships, watched the championships a couple of years as a spectator, and I remember watching this championship one year, and Kingston College got 0 points in the hurdles. And I was up there, and it hurt me to my heart, man. I'm like, this will never happen again as long as I'm here. And so I went down there to volunteer and started coaching the hurdles. Eventually started coaching the sprints and the hurdles. And then that expanded to the long sprints and the hurdles. So I was coaching the 100 meters, the 200 meters, the 400 meters, and all the hurdles at my old high school. We had a group of coaches that were very passionate about, I think Kingston College, when we all got back down there as a group, had finished seventh in the high school championship. And we were very passionate about bringing this thing back to its rightful place, which is we saw ourselves as always on top. We wanted to be back on top. We had a sports master. His name was Kevin Lewis, who was very influential, very steady individual. And he was the person who was really at the core of the leadership. He was our sportsmaster. He was our head coach. And when he migrated, we won the championship with Calvin Lewis at the helm. And then when he migrated, I took over as the head coach. Now, I honestly can't remember if I took over after the first victory or the second victory, but we led Kingston College to 6 consecutive victories in the high school championships, national titles in the high school championships, and a lot of young men getting scholarships overseas. One of the greatest feelings I had was in my last year of coaching at Kingston College as the head coach, which was 2007, we won every single hurdle race on offer.
Wow.
And that was like a perfect closing to a chapter, because when I started there, we got 0 points in the hurdles. And so when I was a student athlete, we used to have what we call the purple patch. Our perennial rivals, Calabar, we would say, if they could survive the purple patch on Saturday, they would win. And the purple patch was the patch where you had all these hurdle races.
Right.
And so we brought my high school coach, Kirk Douglas, he was the architect of that. And so I was proud to bring back the purple patch to Kingston College. And we would know if we could keep them close to the hurdles, we're going to win. And
wow.
So it was great years, 14 years. There's a lot of sacrifices, you can imagine, man. Some family stuff suffered for that. And I give my wife all the credit for keeping our family together, because sometimes I was not there. I was more on the track at the meet at Kingston College more than being at home. And that was the level of passion that we had. We would sit there late nights talking about how to be better, making a chart and a strategy of how to win this thing. We didn't have the recruits to win, so we decided we wanted to take over hurdles and we wanted to take over field events, and that's what we did. And we looked at the points, we analyzed the number of points given by each event, and so therefore, without having very fast sprinters, we realized we could still win the championship. And we set out to do that, man, and it took us about 7 years, but eventually we did. So we lost 7 before we won 6 while I was there. And so, you know, it's the whole tip of the iceberg thing. A lot of people will remember the 6 victories, but they just don't remember the 7 losses to get us there.
Well, I tell you, one of the things that I do cherish is that I get a chance to see it and the successes that you've had, but not only the successes that you personally have had, but all of your athletes that have come through your program and under your tutelage and leadership have had. So let me pivot a little bit. So in terms of the next step, you make it to the collegiate ranks, you're here now and you're doing tremendous things there, but you're also a coach of a world champion, Olympians, and others. What is the difference between, say, coaching at a high school and having victories there, coaching at a university, having victories and accolades there, and now guiding and leading world-class elite athletes? Is there anything different in your approach to each of those areas?
Well, not really a lot, Gerald. I stay in the moment, man. So when I was in the high school setting, I focused on what I needed to do to get these youngsters to the top of the podium, but also what it will take to get them to the next opportunity in life, which was college. Back then, you didn't have a lot of people going professional. And so the focus was primarily to go overseas, get your education, run track for as long as you can, but after track and field, this is what you do. Draw back on the skills that you got academically, that you developed academically along the way. When I moved out of high school and into the university system, it's just that I was a little bit further up on the chain, but the focus was still the same. No, I'm getting kids in high school that I get at 14, 15 years old, sometimes 11 years old, so you become their dad at a very early age and mentor them there. In college, you get them at 16, 17, 18, 19. You become their dad and you mentor them there. Sometimes it was more difficult to shape them or to try to influence their lives because they were already set in certain ways before they came to you. So it was a little bit more difficult. in the collegiate setting. Also, being in the college system in the U.S., you have to also be careful. You have so many rules that you wanted to make sure that you did not violate any of those rules. But in terms of the approach to the young men and the young women, it was very, very similar, because for me, I tell them all the time, my favorite job in the world is being a dad. And I became that. And being a dad to an 11-year-old is a little bit different than being a dad to a 19-year-old or 18-year-old. But as you go through life, you kind of understand the difference. Having my own kids, you know that you move from along that continuum from control to influence. So when they're younger, you have more control. When they're older, you try to be more influential. And so that's the major difference. The professional level, I am still mentoring, man. So when they come before me, Gerald, man, they know, even if they don't know, the people who are already there in that group will tell them, or they will see just by the way we live, that they're all my kids. They're absolutely all of them, whether they're 30 plus years old, like Leiford Green, or whether they're in their early 20s, like Kyra McMaster. They're all my kids, man. And wow. I treat them like that, not disrespectfully, very respectfully, like I would treat my own kid. And I try not to miss an opportunity to teach them something about life. I'm talking to you and I'm thinking of Kyra McMaster. He saw me one day and he was like, Coach, it was after an indoor meet where my wife comes to our indoor meets at Clemson and she sits with the team and everybody knows her now. And he was like, Coach, somebody told me you were married for 31 years, Coach. I'm like, yeah, we're married for 31 years. Coach, but you don't look like you're married for 31 years. You guys look like you just know each other. And I'm like, what does someone who is married for 31 years supposed to look like? And that was a teaching moment. You know, so everything that you do, I try, you know, I've made mistakes in life like everybody else, man. But I really do try to walk the talk.
Yeah.
Not just to say stuff to them, but to live stuff.
Yeah. So and that you do, sir.
Yeah. So basically, it is very important to me that in my relationship with a kid, whether they're 11 or they're 18 or they come to me as a professional at early 20s, I tell them this. I say, whatever you say to me, I will believe you. And you know why? Because whatever I say to you, I want you to know it's the truth. I will never lie to you. So whatever you say to me, I'll believe you. So let's not try to trick Coach Grant, because you're going to understand already that I believe you. I told you I believed you already. So let's just start with integrity, honesty, and let's move from there. So it's not much different. It really isn't much different. The people who you see at the meet is different. There's much more on the line in terms of stakes. The stakes get higher as you go up. But I really, as the coach, don't look at it any differently, man, because I'm not really – it may sound weird or cliche, Gerald, but I'm not motivated by the money. I'm not motivated by what people think of me. I'm motivated by being a child of God. I'm motivated by setting the right examples, maybe bringing a soul to the kingdom. That's what motivates me. So it doesn't seem much different at the different levels to me.
Wow. Well, thank you for that, Coach. That's really, really deep. You know, Coach, these interviews or podcasts usually last an hour. Believe it or not, we're close to an hour. We could be on the phone for almost 3 to 4 hours. That's just...
And I feel like we just started.
We just started. There. That's right. Well, we're definitely going to have a part two. But in the time that we have left, let me ask you the question that I've asked most people who folks look up to. Believe it or not, there are a number of folks across the globe, because they reach out to me and we're part of groups and so on, that you have influenced and continue to influence based upon your imprint on their lives and the connections that you've made over time. Given all that you're seeing today, the dynamics of, we talked about student athletes, we talked about progression, we talked about success. In the remaining time that we have on this episode, because definitely we're going to have you back, But in this episode, what words of wisdom would you, or just words from your own experiences, would you share with those young people who are in the high school level, the young people who are at the collegiate level, or young professionals going out into the work world, or even the athletes who are thinking about becoming professional athletes? What words of wisdom, encouragement, and inspiration could you share with them during this time?
Well, Gerald, to be real, man, I would just really ask these people, no matter what level they're at, try to define your end game. What is it that you really want? How far away is your end game? Is your end game, if you're 20, is your end game being defined as 25? Because if you are, then obviously you're not thinking right. Try to define your end game with the idea that you may live to 70 years old. And when you define that end game, try to figure out where you are right now and what can I do to get to that end game successfully. In other words, stop looking at what's immediately in front of you and broaden your scope a little bit. It might be hard for an 11-year-old to do that, but it shouldn't be that difficult it should be relatively easier for someone who's in their early 20s to do that, or someone who gets to college. They could probably say, what do I want to do out of college? But then after you say that, how is that going to influence your life, or what is your life going to be like 5 years out of college? But start looking down the road, and if you have difficulty looking down the road, try to find someone who could be your mentor, someone who you could talk to about stuff. It's not like they're going to tell you how to live your life, but if you have a thought process that mm-hmm. you're not quite working out, find someone who can help you, someone who is not a yes person, someone who is not scared to tell you that you are making a fool of yourself, and if you continue this way, you're not going to even see 25. You know, you're not going to be successful at 30. Someone who will tell you like it is. And I believe that there are people out there who you can find. I would put a lot of responsibility on the coaches in the primary or high school system, especially to mentor these kids in the right way. Stop making it about going overseas versus staying. Make it about what do you want to be in life and how do you see yourself getting there by staying home or going overseas. If the answers are there for staying home, stay home. There's a lot of distractions that could come up when you leave mom and dad at an early age. But if the answers are not there, then go overseas. But find mentorship, find people for youngsters, they're always a friend who is older than them. And so if you're about to leave high school, there's someone who has maybe left 2 years ago, 3 years ago, who could help you. So for those who went through that door, whether it's the door of the University of Technology, Michael University, University of the West Indies, Clemson University, Alabama State University, Howard University, whatever door, the student athletes that go through that door, don't close that door, man. Only show up locally when you go back to your high school and you have the flashy clothes on and your shoes is great and you're driving your friend's car that you borrowed when you came back to Jamaica and you look good. Don't sell the kid. Tell them the full 100. Be real with them.
Wow.
That's what I would say to you. So the responsibility is on the youngster to find some right people to put in their life. But we know, Gerald, we were youngsters. When you have an adult that is looking over you and helping you to improve yourself, you trust that adult. You believe that they have your interest at heart. So I put the more responsibility on the coaches. I remember, and I digress a little bit, I remember when I was coaching at Kingston College, and I even had two sons who were going to Kingston College. I would drop them off at school in the morning, man, and I would spend the rest of the time on the youth campus, the Melbourne campus, talking to teachers, trying to figure out if these kids are going to class. It's not an easy thing. It's not just going out there and going to the warm-up track and coaching people. You got to get these kids to understand that when you say you want excellence from them, you're backing it up.
Yeah.
You're checking up on them.
Yeah.
If the teacher says they're not at school, you go find a friend. Are they here? Yes, they were here this morning. You search that campus until you find them. And so they, early in their relationship with you, Gerald, they realize that this man is interested in me. He's not necessarily interested in how far I could jump, throw, or run. He's interested in me. He wants me to do this.
Right.
And so you motivate them till they can find motivation internally, man. You push them. You push them. And sometimes you tell them, don't come to practice. Because if you don't go to class, I don't want you in my practice. And when that becomes a reality, not that you're just saying that, Gerald, but you're actually doing that. You're turning them back.
Right.
I had, and I know we're almost out of time, but I had an experience with a young man. His name was Dean Griffiths. And we went to a track and field meet, and he was supposed to be my top man on the 4x4. And he said, Coach, I'm not running the 4x4. And I'm like, oh, you hurt? He said, no, Coach. I said, yeah, you hurt. He said, no, Coach, I'm fine. I said, no, you hurt. You have to be hurt. He says, Coach, I said, I'm fine, but I'm not running. And I said, okay. And so we had to run the 4x4 without the young man. Now, granted, he's about 18 years old, 17. He came back to practice next Monday, and I just told him, hey, man, I'm not coaching you anymore.
Wow.
And he thought I was joking. And 2 weeks later, he realized I was serious. And so we had a heart-to-heart. And it wasn't that I was looking for an apology. I just wanted him to know that I was interested in excellence. And what he did back there was tell me he wanted to quit. And so I helped him to quit. So he came back and he got himself right. And a long story short, ended up at a JUCO, went on to Auburn University, was NCAA champ, went on to represent Jamaica at the World Championship. And I think he tells this story everywhere he goes. And right now, I could tell you, if I forget my birthday, I will know because he's calling. And he's not putting it on social media. He said, Sergi, I am calling you. Dean Griffiths is his name.
Well,
all because one day I decided to use an experience to have a teaching moment.
Wow. Well, Coach, we definitely are going to have you back because we haven't even gotten to the work that you're doing in the professional ranks and you being an Olympic coach for Jamaica and all of those things. But these are the types of stories.
The foundation is important, Barry.
The foundation is very important, and we need to have you back.
Yes, sir.
Because when the dust settles on all of this, it's about these young people and their futures, and that's why we created this podcast. Coach William P. Moultrie at Howard University did exactly the same for us. And when we look across the nation today, the doctors, the lawyers, the CEOs, and the people who are movers and shakers and social entrepreneurs, it's that type of tough love about the student and athletics and that combination that resonates. So, Coach, we're at time, but we definitely will have you back on our show in the future as we continue to inspire and try to lift our young people to stations in life they themselves never thought before. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's our show for this week. I know that you were intrigued by what we shared just now, but I am confident that in the future, these messages that we're sharing will continue to enliven conversations about how we can assist the next generation coming behind us. Remember, this is It's Easy, Son. Life lessons on your journey to your promise. Your promise is real. Your promise is out there. Until next time, have a great week.